Please pray with me. O God, uphold me that I may uplift thee. Amen. Not too long ago, I was asked to do a wedding for a couple of friends, one Christian, one from another faith. And as we began the planning process, the other celebrant called and asked just one thing of me, that I not mention Jesus in the ceremony. It wasn't the first time that I had received such a request. I've given plenty of prayers at public gatherings directing ministers like me to please give only a non-sectarian prayer, which every Christian pastor knows translates into "No Jesus, please." Unlike some Christian ministers, I am very sympathetic to the motives behind this request, even though I cannot abide by it. When the co-celebrant in the wedding shared with me some of her experiences of Christian ministers using Jesus like a club to pummel her and the rest of the non-Christian attendees at a wedding, I had to admit that if I were her, I'd probably adopt the same clear posture. The co-celebrant and I worked it out, but only after hours of conversations that led to trust between two strangers. And by the time we stood together before the couple taking their vows, I believe she understood that it was because of Jesus that I would never intentionally use our faith as a club, not in spite of him. The author of Colossians doesn't have all of that baggage to deal with. In the early second century, in what is now modern-day Turkey, the church hasn't had any power to abuse. It hasn't had the power of numbers, or the power of influence, the power of money, or the power of the state. So when this author argues for the supremacy of Christ, he is arguing to a minority community of people who seem completely irrelevant to the powers and the world around them. And he is writing to a group of people who chose this irrelevancy in the world's eyes for one reason: that they believed that Christ had brought them close to God. They believed that because of Christ, forgiveness had triumphed over the cycle of retribution. Because of Christ, the whole world had changed. But now those same people were questioning whether Christ is sufficient, questioning whether the gospel message is adequate for a world that seemed to be coming unhinged, questioning whether the good news is enough in a world that was beginning to feel out of control. We understand that kind of doubt. Doubting whether God's power is sufficient to live in a world where other evil powers are on the upswing. Whether the gospel message of reconciliation through Christ is adequate in a world where fear seems to be now the main thing that all human beings seem able to share. Whether the good news that Christ has overcome human sin, defeated evil, opened a way beyond death, whether we believe this news is enough for us to live in this world? Because it is not looking sufficient to a lot of the people that I have been listening to these last couple of weeks. Some of us are openly despairing about the state of the world and where it seems to be headed, openly despairing about whether the killing here and around the world is ever going to stop. openly despairing about whether the racism in our country that makes people of color more vulnerable to bad cops is ever going to be addressed or even acknowledged. Openly despairing about whether good cops are becoming so maligned that violence is going to overtake them too. Openly despairing about both the growing divides and the foolish reactions of electorates across the world. Openly despairing about big development deals creating more white upper-class enclaves at precisely the time when Freddie Gray's Baltimore has never been more apparent. I've heard that despair. It sounds like a comment I heard about last week from the tearful words of a black youth who said, "I just don't think white people get it, and I'm not sure they ever will." I heard it from a neighbor who exclaimed, "I don't think I can take the city anymore." I heard it from a police officer who reminded me that the more police feel hated, the less good community-minded people will ever want to become one. I heard it from a business leader who said, "I appreciate your anecdotes about police and residents working together, but if the shootings don't stop, it won't make a bit of difference." And I heard it from a friend, an African-American man, who when asked, "How are you feeling about this week?" simply shook his head as if to say, "Andrew, if I have to explain it to you, it's not even worth getting into." We are confronted this morning with the shocking claim that this gospel message is more than enough to live in the world where the powers of sin and violence or death still seem to be winning. The gospel that claims that God has redeemed the world and is on the way to making it whole. Which is to say that it is a bigger claim than I think a lot of us may be prepared to accept this morning. And maybe that reality puts us a lot closer to those vulnerable Colossians than to their privileged, powerful descendants whose legacy some of us are used to explaining or defending or sometimes condemning. Maybe it puts us a lot closer to those vulnerable Colossians than many of us have ever been or wanted to be. People who doubt the power of the gospel, not from a safe place, but in that place where you know that the world is much more out of your control than you ever wanted to accept. When you have to accept that peace isn't guaranteed, safety is not guaranteed, another day for any of us isn't really guaranteed. Through Christ, the text claims, God was pleased to reconcile God's self to all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of the cross. Because of Jesus, nothing is irreconcilable. No person is beyond God's reach. No part of God's creation is beyond God's repair. God has already taken care of the foundational divide between God and human beings. God has bridged it. The whole world is more in God's hands than it seems. The claim does not get any bigger than that. A confrontation between the evil that we see played out on a daily basis and this gospel that says God is still on the move. I'm kind of glad for this confrontation this morning because I don't have the patience to stand in this pulpit and talk about little chicken soup for the soul moments this morning. It would make me sick to stand here and feed you false hope that comes when a person like me tries to make Jesus look better by saying that the state of the world is not quite as bad as it seems. I couldn't take it if I had to stand here and say that the gospel message is really about theological positions or little spiritual supplements that do not have much to do with what's going on in the world. No, I'm glad to stand here and say either Christ's death and resurrection is evidence that the powers of this world do not win, or none of what we do here is important. Either Jesus is in fact Lord, which is to say that God makes sure that suffering love leads to somewhere, even when we don't see it, that forgiveness is more powerful than the cycle of retribution, that love is stronger than fear, or we should just shut down the church and go home. Here's the hard part of this gospel. The hard part from Colossians is that the greatest testimony to the truth of the gospel doesn't come when things are going well. It doesn't come when life or the world is working out the way that you had hoped it to, or even the way that is right and just. Sure, gratitude can be a powerful testimony to the power of faith in our life. But the most powerful testimony, according to the writer of this book, is when the baptized are given an opportunity to suffer for God's way. Are given an opportunity to suffer for what is good and right and true. I am now rejoicing in my sufferings for your sake, and in my flesh I am completing what is lacking in Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, that is the church. It is not that God enjoys anyone's suffering or looks to exact suffering from any one of us. I don't think that is what the writer is saying at all. It is not that God sends suffering so that others can find faith. We do not worship that kind of a sadistic God. No, I think that when we suffer for the sake of what is good and right and true, we are close to experiencing, or closer to experiencing and closer to knowing the mystery of God's love for us, of a God who loves us so much that she chooses to suffer on our behalf. And when the world sees that kind of love lived not when things are easy or secure or safe, but in the face of evil, in the face of despair and injustice, then the word is made known. Christ is made known. God is revealed for a people hungry for nothing less. Don't you know if Christ was the one that Christians declared as supreme, the one risking healing in the midst of violence, the one overturning those tables of injustice, the one crossing boundaries justified by layers of history and culture, the one choosing to give his life not just for the sake of his followers, but for every bit of God's creation, then we would never, I would never have to worry about offering Jesus-free prayers. It wouldn't even come up, because our friends and family of other faiths would know the depth of our love for them, not if they believed in Jesus, but because we do. We wouldn't have two Baltimores because the poor would know the depth of the church's love for and with them until the day that they and we become as much of a priority as all of our other priorities. Black men and women might know that their lives do matter to a church and will matter to the nation because they'd see a church unwilling to let racism in our culture go unacknowledged and unaddressed and unchecked. And the great majority of the police in our nation who really do want to protect and serve, and the great majority of young people in our city's neighborhoods who really do want to be safe, would be at a table hosted by the church. And they'd probably be willing to meet us there because we would have demonstrated the depth of our commitment to carve a path of nonviolence forward, even at risk, at a risk to ourselves. That is the faith of the writer of this book. One who walks toward the fires instead of away from them because he knows that God is already there. God is always there amid the hurt, amid injustice, amid the loss, amid the suffering. And the church has an invitation to join God there too. With the vulnerable, amid the suffering, where God's love is never more real.